We are live. Hi, Bob Cooney here, but you already know that. Most of you probably know, wait, where is he? This dude. Gotta go backwards. Say hi, Kevin.
Hi, everyone. And thank you very much for having us on, Bob, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thanks for joining. This is the first of a series of webinars that we'll see how attendance and registration goes, how long it lasts. My intention is this will go through the year. We've got a full slate already through February, and in fact, I just got an email from Leif Peterson from Hologate, so his team's going to join us. I think in February. And so when you registered, I'll continue to send updates of who we've got going, but I've sent out invitations to quite a few influencers. And the intention here is a lot of the webinars that I've done have been kind of really high level, skirting the surface, covering a lot of shit in a really short period of time. And I thought I would do something that was a little bit of a different approach, where we can actually go really deep with people and deeper into subjects, deeper into products, deeper into technology, into solutions, into operations. And so for people that are really serious about VR, not just curious or interested, but really serious about it, this is the thing that hopefully people can really learn the inside shit that could make the difference between being successful or struggling or even, God forbid, failing. So anyway, Kevin Williams, Kevin and I have known each other for a long time. We worked together when I was at Global VR. I met Kevin, was at Infogram, and we were talking about licensing some of Infogram's consumer content to put into the VR Vortec product, and that was probably in 98 or 99.
And we crossed paths. We followed each other. I was doing some stuff for Edison when they were just taking on virtuality, because I used to consult. Oh, wow. Or I did some stuff with virtuality back then. So again,
yeah, I forgot about that. You're right. And so that was back in the Laserstone days for me with virtuality. Yep. And Edison Brothers. Wow.
And I partied with your girls on your booth.
That was Qzar, not me. Come on, man.
Oh no, I partied on your booth because you had girls as well on your booth.
Was that NSM with the body painting?
Yes.
Ah, okay, cool. Yeah, that was much later. But so Kevin and I go back 20 plus years in the immersive entertainment space. And Kevin's an ex. Give your background. For those that don't know, Kev, give a little bit of your background going back to Disney. And
all right, so I've always worked in the out-of-home entertainment market. I started at the beginning with the microcomputers, then got sucked into the arcade industry pretty hard. Then spent some time in military simulation, turning simulation tech into theme park and entertainment. Then virtual reality back in the 90s. I was then headhunted by Walt Disney Imagineering to work for them there in the Glendale offices, first on Disney Quest and then helping on some other projects. Jumped across to Infogrames after some time in the States, setting up their arcade entry that fizzled and bubbled, and then set up our consultancy in 2004. I also write something called the Stinger Report, which is a scurrilous, rubbishy piece of information that covers the sector, and I write for a number of trade pubs.
It is, and now I'm going to see if I can figure out how to, there it is, it's this little plus thing. There we go, so I'm just putting up a link to the Stinger Report in the chat window, and so if you click that, it'll open up hopefully in another browser, not this one, you can subscribe to it. It's been going on forever. It's become a bit more mainstream, I think, Kevin. But back in the day, it was like Kevin used to love to stir the pot, and he would write all the shit that nobody wanted written. Yep. But now that he's got over 9,000 subscribers or something like that, right?
Yeah. It's we claim 17,000, but we've got a 20% click through, so it's more likely 10.
All right, that's an amazing. So anyway, so get the Stinger Report. It's a great resource to find out. Kevin's what I what what uh what my friends in Australia would call a sticky beak.
That's me.
Which is he sticks his beak into what everyone is doing, and he knows more about who's doing what in virtual reality than anybody I know. Like, if I need to know anything about who's doing what, Kevin's my resource.
I have to be more specific. My main focus is immersive entertainment. So it's everything in the XR bullywick at the moment. I don't, you know, Bob's the guru of VR. I'm just a sticky beak across a multitude of disciplines.
Yeah. And so, so Kevin's a trusted resource of mine. And anytime I need something that goes beyond my ability to, like, either grasp it around the other technologies, like he said, or like who are the players in this, or what's happening in the technology in these areas. Kevin's a great resource for me. So follow him and follow the Stinger Report.
And vice versa, right, follow Bob.
So yeah, thank you, Kev. So let's get into what I hope is interesting stuff. I also want you guys to know I am monitoring the chat. And so if you've got questions, I will try to, you know, post them there, and I'll try to make sure that they get addressed. So what do you want to start with, Kev?
Well, I think if we're going to start 2019, we better go through the trends that we're seeing. And I suppose one of those trends is trying to define some standards so we understand what the hell we're talking about concerning this sector. So I was going to start off talking about one of the biggest plays that we're seeing at the moment in the sector, and that is arena scale or warehouse scale backpack VR kind of experiences. Not just backpack, of course.
Yeah. And so when you let's define that, because I think definition is language is important. So when you say, what's the size of those, when you say like arena scale to warehouse scale, you know, warehouse scale, I think zero latency came up with that term, which is 2,000 square feet or more. What's the low end of that? How small would you go and call it that?
10,000 is as small as I'm going at the moment, though I have seen people working 10,000, on smaller.
10,000 what? 1,000 square feet.
Sorry, 1,000 square feet is the minimum. Yeah. 100 square meters. Yeah. The issue is how big is we are now talking literally warehouses. There's that place in Chicago that's opened up, which is the whole of a warehouse ground structure turned into a virtual experience for over 20 individuals.
Is that Mass VR?
That's the one. So it's out of control. It really is, and that's.
Let's talk about that. So Mass VR has they're using radio RF tracking, I'm just going to caveat everything here of saying that, like, I demo all this shit or a lot of it, and they might evolve after I demo them. So, you know, it's entirely possible that they've done something to improve the experience, but the radio stuff by itself isn't very accurate. It's centimeter accurate, and you know, and for a comparison, what's the accuracy of Lighthouse, would you say?
They're claiming a peak timing of a micro millisecond positional placements. So if you
millimeter, right? It's like super accurate.
So OptiTrack, OptiTrack point is the most accurate. Then you have Lighthouse 2. And then you have the Wi-Fi radio systems, which are the most, pardon my English, the least accurate.
Yeah. And so the big stuff that we're seeing, I think, if you were to try to do that with optical, it would be ridiculously expensive.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And Lighthouse, what's Lighthouse now? Lighthouse, I know people are pushing the limits up to 1,000 square feet.
Well, they're daisy chaining. So we have a number of clients or companies that we've seen, and again, Bob's quite right to do this. We have to caveat the point is that we're looking at demonstrations and demos, and a lot of this stuff is still in iteration form and being developed. But we're seeing people now looking at Lighthouse 2, which is this the standard you have to go with now, and they're daisy chaining them together. So rather than just having two or four, you can have six or eight or 24 daisy chain lighthouses. And that's a path that some people are going down. There's also a flip side where you have people using Windows MR, their inside out tracking system, which is also being belted and braced. It's being supported by another medium, which is optical image tracking linked to Inside Out. So the big stuff is done with the positional tracking, and then the small stuff is being done with Inside Out.
All right, and for those of you that are kind of new to the technology, the Inside Out is basically depth sensing cameras, similar to what you know you're seeing on the iPhone now, where it can read depth and lots of points, and it creates this point cloud, and then based on how that point cloud moves, it projects where you're moving within the system, and all the stuff's in the headset, so you don't require external cameras. And I want to touch on that for a second with you, but I want to finish the. So, what's the most people have pushed the envelope as far as daisy chaining Lighthouse 2.0 into like a large scale installation right now?
About 4,000, 5,000.
And is that in the lab or is that actually in the wild yet? Do you know?
Not in the wild yet.
Okay. All right. But it's coming,
so,
right?
It's coming. Yeah. And the Chinese have been the first to start daisy chaining. There's a company called Leke VR, who's a partner with
HTC. How would you spell that?
Leke VR. Or is it Leke? Yeah, it's Leke. Leke, yeah. Yeah, the big words are difficult. That's it. Yeah, and the issue with those guys is because of their relationship with HTC, they're getting the gin early, and they've got a couple of small arena scale VR systems that use Lighthouse 2.
Interesting. Wow. So from a standards perspective, are there limitations then when you daisy chain Lighthouse into how many players, how many things, objects you can track within, and what's that limitation like? You know,
it's the phrase I've been shouting all of last year, and a phrase that I've been using a lot this year. It's all about the content. Content is king, and it's dependent on the skill of the development team and how much they're willing to get deep and dirty into the trenches to get the most out of the technology. You have to play with the firmware, and that's part of the issues that we're seeing. If you can't get that deep and dirty into it, then it doesn't work. And if you can, then you have to do a whole lot of programming to get this stuff to work correctly. And that's an issue. None of this is plug and play.
Okay. So, but you didn't answer the question. So Lighthouse, I think what I've seen the demos, I've seen Lighthouse now. The biggest I've seen was 1,000 square feet, 4-player full body tracking plus controllers. Object tracking, you might be tracking a dozen devices, you know, things, objects.
Yes.
But are there obviously occlusion's an issue. So is it really just occlusion that is the limitation? And if the space is big enough and the players are far enough apart, you could track a limitless number of players, or is there some hard baked technological limitation that you're aware of?
Occlusion is a real big issue, even with Lighthouse, even with OptiTrack, even with the new infrared systems. Also, the number of items. Most people are forgetting that a lot of this arena scale, you've got the weapon, which is either one or two, depending on how you've programmed it, the person itself, the head-mounted display, and now the new issue. A lot of people have looked at the void and looked at other arena scale systems, and they're now tracking feet because they're seeing that feet tracking is important. So you're running out of sources. Either you cut back and you have relatively large numbers of people, large groups of people, but poorly tracked, or you have detailed tracking and you only have limited number of people. You know, you look at how companies like Motion Reality, who is one of the first developers of backpack VR systems, who are doing it in the noughties, long before the entertainment applications, they track feet. They've always tracked feet.
I got to go in so many different directions. I'm going to keep coming back to the standards question.
You're the ringmaster.
But when you talk about foot tracking, like my thing with foot tracking is, if you're not building foot tracking into the consumer experience in a way that's meaningful, you're just wasting resources, time. You're making your employees deal with feet. I've actually interviewed employees who have to work at places that do foot tracking.
Yeah.
And sorry, Doug, because I know you're watching, and they fucking hate it. Like they loathe it. You could just see it in their face. They're like, ugh. And it's like, you know, what was his name? Married with Children? Bundy? Frank Bundy?
I can see him.
Like, unless you have a foot fetish, Al Bundy. Thank you, Dave.
Al Bundy.
unless you have a foot fetish, that's not something you want to do 100 times a day. And so there's got to be a reason. And it feels like the people that are doing it, the reason they're doing it is because they can't get the inverse kinematics right. Like, is it that hard? It doesn't feel like it should be that hard.
Well, there's some people that swear by foot strapping. One of the issues is that we have spent a lot of time in virtual environments and experiences, and we don't feel the discontinuity as much as some people. Foot tracking does help a lot of people, but to feel more immersed and not to trip over themselves. Yeah. But you are right. If you haven't got the kinetics of the body skeleton right in the game experience, then it doesn't matter. You just use feet tracking to sort out the problem. And again,
I think when you're walking over a plank, like in Nomadic, or your polygon step onto a platform and then hit a button and the platform moves, you know, the hand tracking and foot tracking then becomes really important to the actual consumer experience. But I haven't seen that consistently, and I haven't done all the Dreamscape stuff. I was supposed to do the two new experiences and I didn't get to do them, but I didn't think in Alien Zoo there was a reason for foot tracking. Anyway, we're getting a bit down a rat hole. You want to wrap up the foot tracking thing, and we're going to go back to standards.
Let's go back to standards.
Anything else you want to say? All right, let's go back to standards. So the fact that that occlusion is a problem, and for those of you that aren't aware, occlusion is the shadowing that happens in an outside-in tracking system where, all of a sudden the cameras lose you, and then they don't know where to place you in the environment, and then you spin out of control, or the environment freezes. And from a consumer standpoint, that can be terrible. It can be like when it happens to me, I just stop moving because it makes me uncomfortable. It makes me feel like I'm going to fall, I'm going to run into something. Right? It's terrible. And so, what are from a standard standpoint, if we're going to go to Lighthouse, but the problem is, as they go bigger, the rent goes up. And you need to put more people in it to make money. And the more people you put in, you get occlusion, which means you're going to have to layer more technology on it, maybe for some kind of a hybrid practice. And then the cost just spirals up. Like, where do you see these standards settling to where there's an economic model that works for the operator? Like, what's it going to – is there – for free roam, we're talking about arena to warehouse scale still.
Right. So there are two points here. Number one, when's it going to be cost effective to develop it? Well, that's a manufacturer's problem. And there is a strong possibility that we're going to see the tracking companies and the computer companies and the head-mounted display companies coming together and formulating plans. That's a lot of people are talking about that kind of approach, utilizing the Oculus Quest system. And I know there's a lot of conversations being had by those companies towards that. You've also got the situation of new technology breaking the rules. And we have a number of companies in the wings that are developing better than or equal than OptiTrack kind of systems that are going to be much more cost effective.
Outside-in tracking.
Both. There's a company that approached us recently that is developing a camera system that it handles multiple points, but using smaller self-contained cameras and at a tenth of the price of OptiTrack. And hopefully, if they can get their stuff together.
The cameras are mounted in the environment, not on the person or on the equipment.
Correct. Yes. So the cameras, so it's a replacement to what OptiTrack's doing it, but in a cost-reduced and a micromanaged package. But again, this is blue sky. We need to actually see this being deployed into the stuff. And then what I was alluding to earlier, which is using inside-out tracking with image points. So this can all bring the price down. But again, it's about the game content. And it's about the ROI. If that game is good enough and people come back and play it again and again and again, then this technology can be a lot more expensive rather than cheap. Sometimes, we always joked about a Pong. You know, you could have painted the Pong arcade cabinet in gold and charged a vast amount of money. It was making so much lettuce when it was dropped into arcade facilities. If the product is strong enough and it causes players to come and play it, sometimes it doesn't really matter how expensive. It's only now where we're trying to build the formula that we're worrying about cost, you know, ROI, return on investment.
Yeah, I get that. So I absolutely agree with that. So, so it sounds to me what I'm seeing happening, and I want your opinion on this, is that this 1,000 square foot, 100 square meter, four player Lighthouse 2.0 backpack based, maybe going to, so somebody just asked a question about Vive Wireless, and then somebody else said TPcast Business Edition. Yeah. Vive Wireless decided to release only three channels, even though there's six channels there.
Yes.
What are you hearing about there? I've heard rumors they're going to release a fourth channel soon.
Well, they were telling everybody at IALPA that they have the fourth channel about to be open, but a friend of mine's telling me that they're running into FCC issues. So,
yeah, that's it's a licensing. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And the technology, I talked to the product manager at CES last year, and he said technology, actually, they have six channels. And so
I've only ever seen three.
Yeah, I've only seen three work, but they have in the technology a six. And so if they get to four, I think that's a good sign. What about TPcast? I've heard mixed things. Actually, I've heard nothing but bad shit about TPcast, to be honest with you. But I don't know that many people using it. What do
nice
you know about
warm.
TPcast?
Nice and warm. of course, they were at VR Days Europe, the guys. There was a demonstration from the TPcast guys there. They haven't got their excrement together. They've promised a lot and delivered a little. We noticed that our friends at VR Studios has now moved across to the Vive wireless system. And the year before last, been talking quite heavily with TPcast. It's always this kind of situation where when new technology comes out, fantastic, but then you have, when the rubber meets the road, it has to prove what it can do. The things we know about TPcast are the software's a little bit difficult to work with and the systems get hot.
Yeah, okay, cool. And so whether Vive Wireless goes four player or not, that'll replace the backpack, that'll make it easier for operators, shift some of the weight to the head, it could be a little uncomfortable, blah, blah, blah. I feel like one of the standards that's emerging in a very natural way is a four player, 100 square meter, 1,000 square feet, free roam thing. That's the standard, like running Lighthouse. Running Lighthouse, right?
A Lighthouse or a small track system or multiple.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be a standard, right? Like, I think that if we're looking for a standard, so let's talk about standards. Standard. What does it mean? What is a standard? Like, talk to me about what your mind is. What is a standard? Because I know you talk a lot about this. Charlie Fink and you had a webinar or something about this. By the way, I'm going to be doing one of these with Charlie on Thursday morning next week, live from CES. So we'll probably touch on the same subject. But looking what's a standard to you?
So standards for me, I'm very lazy. And so I need to pigeonhole this technology that I see so I can write about it easily. And so I create mini standards. People who read the Stinger Report know that I talk about VR arcade machines, VR simulators, VR arena scale, immersive cave systems. I create simple standards so I can pigeonhole a product when I see it. So I can look at something Major Meg's Hollow Deck.
Hyperdeck.
Thank you. Hyperdeck. Too many hypers and hollows. Look at their system, and I can say that's a motion based, tethered, because you know it's a wired head mounted display, gun mounted experience. That is as far as I go personally regarding standardization of products. It's nomenclature of ease of description. That's a four wheel drive vehicle. That's a motorbike. That's a Porsche. That's a racing car or a sports car.
I'm glad I asked that question because that's not what I think about standards. So when I think
you're talking about standard. Yeah, go on.
Standards to move the industry, right? So to me, I'm like, if there's a standard, and I'll use the four player backpack Vive system because I think that's the easiest one. And the reason I feel like that's an emerging standard is because there's 30 companies that are building the same thing, and they're all trying to position it differently. which at some point becomes impossible, because the only differentiation then is going to be the content, which is going to be good for the industry, because if the content gets amazing, the industry will grow. But right now, a lot of the content feels similar. And so,
you're talking about platform standards. Now that's different. That's sales product. So what we could say,
by
pure fluke, a standard has been, not fluke, by skill and development time, a standard has been created, or a product standard has been created with the tethered VR structure. That's what we have with Hologate. Fundamentally, Hologate, everybody is kind of building around the same concept, even though people are going for their own kinds of hardware, their own kinds of connections, their own kind of firmware and customer integration systems, touchscreen systems. What I would love to see is all of that standardized under one flag, and that's what you're referring to as a standard.
Yeah, I think so. I think, and what happens is then people can just buy the shit off the shelf, the operators keep the cost down. And then it's up to the content providers to get their content to market. Because when I'm talking to operators, the number one thing I got from operators at IAPA was, and this is a shift in the industry. Back, you know, when you and I were first working on the VR Vortec and the shit, when we were trying to sell that as a platform, people were like, what's a platform?
Yeah.
That was the question. Like, I just want one good game. And when we had Beachhead, which I want to talk to you, I don't know if we'll have time, but I want to talk about that video you sent me this morning about the new Beachhead, which blew my mind. Like, really? Wow.
You got to share that video.
Yeah, I know. I'm going to share that video. And I just want to jump in, Jonas. Yeah, Y-Dreams was showing a three-player, fairly large-scale wireless at IAPA. And for those of you that are interested in holodeck and hybrid tracking, we're going to, next Friday, I'll be interviewing Johnny and his team. We'll be talking about hybrid tracking and how RF can work with inside out and optical and stuff like that.
So a lot of work,
like Friday morning. But yeah, so I just lost my train of thought. Whoa, platforms. So this idea of a platform, what operators are telling me now is one game's not enough. They want a pipeline of content. They want to be able to take content off the shelf. They want to know it's coming from a lot of different places. And I think that's the App Store mentality. I think Apple basically gave everybody a platform in their pocket, and now they understand the value of that. And but that's Apple what operators are looking for.
Yeah, but Apple got rid of all, because there were so many cell phones, smartphones at that point, that all had special hardware features. What Apple created was a platform that was a blank piece of paper, a blank slate for people to work on. There's this phrase that someone was quoting to me, which is a quote attributed to Henry Ford, which is Henry Ford was saying, if I'd done what people had asked me, I would have created quicker horses. You know, I don't believe the operators know what they want. I really don't. This is a tangent conversation we can have.
Actually, it's a really important point, Kevin, and I'm going to be doing some content on this. And this is something for solution providers when you're designing products. You got to be really careful about listening to customers, because they don't know what's possible. And you have to get to the deeper why. You have to ask why five times. There's a thing called the five whys. Look it up online. And it's around design research. And you have to ask why over and over and over to get to the underlying issue. And my belief with the why they want a platform is because they're nervous about getting boxed in to an expensive hardware platform where the company that's supporting that with content goes out of business, and then they're left with a whole bunch of parts that they can't support.
Bingo.
So that's really what they want. And I think what's happening is, and the thing that I'm starting to really push for is, who can be the front end of the content, the app store for all of these indies. So, you know, the Google Doc that floats around on Google with all the licenses for the arcade games, right? And there's like 30 free roam Lighthouse games on there that are all from what I would consider indie developers. And so like, if I were operating it and I had the bandwidth, I would build my own four player system and I would just license my own content, but nobody has the time for that. So we need to somebody needs to jump on that. I'm pushing the guys from Synthesis to do that because I really like their platform, and we'll see what happens. But anyway, that's one standard.
I would like to get all of the guys in a room. So that the doc that Bob's alluding to, some people have seen the GIF that I posted. It's the baseball bat at the meeting from Goodfellas. It's that kind of these guys. Springboard. Yes, I can see someone's posted springboard. And then, of course, our friends from Viport Arcade will try and beat me up. It's synthetic. And there's two new companies that are entering the market now.
That's crazy. You know, like, if you're entering that market now, just stop and rethink.
I get it. I mean, what the? I get it, guys. The point is we need to get together and, just bang our heads together. I know, personally feeling, I've been through this rodeo before, and I think we're at that very close point where the bubble starts to shrink a little bit, and we're going to see changes and restructurings of companies. And this is where, if we have a standardized platform, we survive. It's something that the video arcade industry went through, where, you had to get all of the arcade video manufacturers into a room and beat them up. And so we didn't have to keep on removing an exactly similar machine and replace it with an exactly similar machine.
And one of those standards was JAMA, right? The Japanese.
Correct.
And that dictated the wiring harnesses and and
how it didn't take away the creativity.
No, what it did is it moved it all to the software and the experience, and a little bit to innovative control mechanisms. But for the most part, it was buttons and joysticks. And then you had to make a great game. And so I feel like that's where we're heading, at least. And so, all right, so one standard that I see, and I feel like you're not disagreeing with this, at least, is this 10 by 10 meter, 100,000 square feet, 100 square meter.
Agreed.
Lighthouse 2. So what about the four-player cubes? What about the four-player tethered for now, unless Vive goes to four channels with wireless, Hollow Gate, Chaos Jump, Vex, blah 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 blah.
Minority we play VR.
Play VR is no play VR, which is the
play VR. Yeah, we play that pack.
So what about that? Like Hollow Gate's crushing the competition. All right, they're way out in front. They had a big head start. They've got a lot of
300 units sold.
Yep. And part of me doesn't want to believe that. But I know life, and Germans are not ones to tend to exaggerate, right? So
are very focused guys. They don't need to exaggerate if they don't need to. For them to allow me to run with the story and the stinger saying 300 units are in their order book, I believe them. Yeah. And as my father used to say, nothing sucks more than success. They've now got to build those machines and maintain those machines. And maintaining those machines and keeping that revenue is going to be a pain in the... Yes, Bob?
And look, and this is a great, and we didn't plan this, but this is a great segue. I'm going to take a short commercial interruption, and I'm going to put up a link to a workshop that I'm and an online program that I'm launching this week. And so you guys are first to hear about it. And so the number one question I get from companies that have seen Holodeck success is, who's my CreativeWorks? How do I get a distributor? And so I'm launching.
Or your Funovation.
Or your Funovation, or your Studio 41B, who's working with Arcave. I assume you had something to do with that. Nice job. So that's the number one question I get. I've created a program. It's a hybrid program of online and a live workshop in Vegas, March 25th, the day before Amusement Expo. And I'm trying to make it a little bit more affordable than doing the custom mentoring programs with me that tend to be very expensive for startup companies. So anyway, if you're interested, check that out. There's information there. If you have questions, you can drop me an email at vrbob@bobcooney.com and I can answer any questions you have. Back to your normal, regularly scheduled programming. And so four-player tethered trust-based systems, I know that's a standard from your perspective.
Yeah.
Can it become an industry standard? And is that just mean Hollow Gate owns it and everybody has to take their content through them?
Well, at this moment in time, we know that Hollow Gate is focused wholly on their own content. They are doing licensing agreements, and I'm sure down the road we're going to see more content created. But the argument of getting Hollow Gate to, shall we say, embrace Springboard, for argument's sake. It's not really something that's going to happen. Though, that said, we have seen Exit Reality and Springboard and Neurogaming come together. So we will see the formulations of partnerships. Sometimes it's not always the front runner who, you know, usually the other people are playing catch up. That's the lovely thing about competition, is it forces everybody to up their game, as it were. And what I think is going to happen is, depending on how our friends at Intel sort their stuff out, you know, we are going to see the tethered system superseded by the wireless system, please. Yep. And then at that point, it you know, there's a lot of guns to the head. One of the quickest ways for this market to blossom is there to be standardized platforms with SDKs out there, software development kits out there, that developers who are now having to pivot from developing consumer VR are now looking to try and create money, can pivot towards a revenue sharing or a revenue model in the outer home entertainment, so we all win. And so we have a rehash of what happened with the arcade industry back in the 80s. That's what I'm hoping for. That's what I'm trying to encourage. The problem is, there are a lot of people with vested causes here. And I understand, you know, I understand you put a lot of your own money into this. You've developed a concept that you think is fantastic, and you think that you should be the only kid in town allowed to play with the football. And if anyone wants to do anything different, you take your football and you go somewhere else. That may be great for you, but it's not going to help an industry.
Yeah, and ultimately, those, in most cases, those models have lost the long game. They win the short game, but they've lost the long game, right? And so I think that, you know, the notion that one person gets to dictate. I was talking to somebody last week, and they were saying, yeah, we want to, you know, we want to have an open platform. And but what he meant was, we want to be the guys that decide what content gets on it. And I'm like, that's not an open platform.
It's a silo.
And so how do you feel like is that going to emerge? And is that something the industry really needs? I know it's what the operators want, but is it what they need? Are they asking for what they really need, or is that too dangerous? Like, do operators really know how to select good content? Like, would they use it?
No, they don't. So, well, most of the operators have looked, you know, if you look at the arcade industry, the operators have always looked the golden goose directly, the horse in their mouth, and made mistakes. You know, the number of people that picked, Rally X rather than Defender, though it was doing better numbers. And again, it's a situation we're seeing with all of the people that have taken on board LAI's Rabbids Big Ride. Virtual Rabbids is a phenomenal successful machine, but there were the number of individuals that went out of their way to not get that machine because.
Yeah, and I just want to qualify the term operator, because again, language is important.
Yes.
And so when Kevin and I are talking about operators, we're talking about kind of family entertainment center, amusement operators, guys that operate arcades and stuff like traditional arcades, redemption arcades, video game arcades, not VR arcade operators. VR arcade operators are much more savvy about the content they offer, and you know, and they're trialing and erroring, and they're going out and finding stuff, and they seem to get it because they're really close. It's cottage industry, and those guys are close to the consumer, and they know what people want to play, where I think the amusement operators are running bigger businesses, and they're not quite as close to the consumers.
We have a problem in the amusement industry. No. It is an assumption. So there are caveats here, but the problem that I have had working in the amusement industry so long is that you kind of see the amusement industry doesn't talk to its clients. When I do meetings with clients that are arcade corporations, and I say, well, let's talk about the customer, they think I'm talking about the operator who's buying their product, not the people who are playing their products, the gamers that are actually paying their wages. And the difference between what I'm seeing in the VR arcade sector is that most VR arcade operators have actually touched their audience. They've actually interspersed with them. They've talked to them. They understand their positionings, because they have to know the games that they want to play. Where the arcade manufacturers still don't really have that much close proximity to their players, and they have to depend on what the operators tell them, and sometimes the operators tell them what they want to hear.
All right, so those are the two things that I see. Are there any other standards that you see emerging besides the four player tethered trust thing and the 1,000 square foot backpack free roam? What else?
Well, we've got the VR rooms, So the
White House 10x10. Yep.
Yeah, 10x10, really standardized PC, Lighthouse, headset, tether, cable tie. That's standardized. We've got now standardization in the motion seat VR experience. You know, so you look at things like our friends at CJ 4Dplex have developed, where they've taken what they were doing in the 4DF market and turned it towards virtual reality. And we've got some standardization on the Chinese systems. We've got a plethora of motorbike VR experiences, and we're going to have a plethora of racing car VR experiences, you know, white machine sitting on motion base with Deepoon headset on.
Yeah. And immersion seems to be taking a lead in that market. And I know you've done some work with them. What's your, you know, what's your view there? You know, obviously
world domination,
can say.
So, you know, Emotion, we've done some consultancy with them. They've set up their experience centers. So they're taking, they cherry pick the best of the Chinese VR systems. They have a partnership with VR Leke that I've already mentioned. And they're putting their own content on. So rather than taking a risk by using the Chinese content,
they started with getting Chinese content and realized they started terrible. And now they're doing their own content. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're coming up with a package, a form factor that can be franchised and dropped into high foot traffic locations. And I like to call those pop-up VR experiences, something that can be put in a temporary location, can pull people through. And that is a multitude of experiences. And that, for me, fundamentally is the trend of where we're going now. We're not seeing a one concept fits all solution for the people who are making the most money out of VR. We're seeing a candy box, a multitude of different flavors and different types of systems. And this is where new trends in technology are being deployed. So part of what we're seeing being deployed into this candy box is the addition of esports. A lot of people now, thankfully, have worked out that it's about getting the person back. Something I present at Foundations Entertainment University that talks to the family entertainment center investors and the urban entertainment site investors.
And by the way, if you're in the operations business, you should go to Foundations. Like, just Kevin, can I put a link? Can you put a link?
Oh yeah,
to the website. We should have done that.
Of course. I will. While we're speaking, I will grab a link to that. But I think the thing that you've got to understand here is we've learned from doing foundations that you spend so much money getting paying for marketing to get people to come into your facility that it's so stupid to just treat them as a one-trick pony. You know, they came into our facility and they'll never come back again. You've got to look at this as a repeat business. Repeat visitation should be your mantra as soon as you walk through the door of your operation. I just put a link up to foundations there.
Thank you. Thank you also, Russ, for hitting that one. And I think your Vegas one is sold out, right?
It looks like it. Yeah, we've got one in London in a couple of days' time. We've got one in March just before Amusement Expo. And then we're going to do one in Dallas and one in Chicago this year.
Yeah, awesome. And so, hey, Mark, good question. Let's circle back to that. Because the esports thing is here. So I was talking to Jan Gutluk from Virtuix Omni, and they've got a massive installed base of 3,000 of these Omni treadmills, and mixed opinions about them. I don't want to get into that. But what they've done a lot of is competition, and they've done a lot of esports tournaments, and they've had $50,000 prize pools, and they've had thousands of participants. And he gave me a statistic recently that was really fucking underscored what you're talking about around repeat play and getting people to come back. So they ran a tournament with a modest prize pool in November. The winning team played 14 times to secure their high score. And the average team played 7 times. The average team played 7 times to get into the finishing, into the scoring bracket. And so
$20 ahead?
Yeah, $20, $30 ahead. getting somebody to play a game seven times. So people talk about repeat playability. People love, in the right location, people
and
love
it's
competition.
It's not just those four guys. It's their friends. It's the people standing outside the machine watching this. The esports phenomenon is not just the people playing, not just the people watching the stream, not just the audience, but all of the stuff that goes with it, the secondary and tertiary spend. People are leaving that cheddar on the table.
Yeah, and so Jeremy, the recommendation is esports, is competition. And, you know, esport is like just a new word for competition and tournaments. We were running tournaments in the laser tag business.
Bowling.
In the 90s, right? Bowling, yeah, exactly. Repeat league play was, and so, and now people aren't willing to commit to 30-week competitions anymore, like winter league bowling was back in the day. But people do love to compete. And I think that's why you see these indoor karting centers being so successful is there's this inherent competition. People go compete with their friends. If you go to Dave & Buster's on Saturday night and you see Papa Shot in the basketball games, people and skee ball, people are competing. There's a company called Brewski Ball, which is running skee ball tournaments in bars, and they freaking sell out. And so people love to compete. And so taking something as cool as a bar and wrapping it. Yeah, absolutely. Bocce, right? Bocce competitions. Yeah. And so, and there are some platforms that I saw at IAPA that I really liked. I think Virtuix Omni from that's being distributed by Funovation had a tournament system built into it. The one that I'm a big fan on is Polygon from Neurogaming. And they have, what I love about their system is it actually live streams to Twitch and YouTube. So players can live stream the virtual images from the game, the streams from the game, the in-game footage to their fans and friends, which creates that viral thing. And that thing's going to be wildly successful if it gets off the ground. And so, yeah. So esports, what else are you seeing in the esports space that people can sink their teeth into?
Well, so with the VR hat on, you've touched on the big investments as well as Springboard VR. They're looking towards quite an extensive esports element, which they've been marrying to the work that they've done with Beat Saber Arcade, which was interesting to see because that is
Beat Saber. They ran a tournament in October or November, I think, didn't they?
Yep. So we're going to see that.
Have you seen data from that? I haven't seen any data from that as far as repeat play.
I'm deep in the trenches trying to get this manuscript on the second book sorted out, but I promise that I'm going to go back and start collecting the people have been sending me metrics of facility operations, what they're seeing, and I want to nail this down and maybe throw this to you or someone so you can be circulated to the audience. We need to get the metrics out there. There's another company that I was at IALPA. We saw our friends at VRX who are developing a driving VR race system, which is part of a esports component. And then there's CXC, a European company that's been doing a lot of tournament-based racing esports style entertainment. You know, esports is a generic term that people have used to describe a particular kind of competition, you know, Twitch gaming, audience watching, streaming live. But, you know, we're seeing this being applied in other areas. And then away from that, we see the normal esports investment. Because, you know, don't get greedy. You don't have to just have a VR operation in your location-based entertainment. You can have VR here. You can have an esports tournament table set up, like our friends at Creative Works have been selling into the market. You can throw in
Mindtrek. By the way, Mindtrek in Boston just added a 12-seat VR, their own. They did their own. They didn't buy the Creative Works one, but they just added 12 seats of esports. I don't have any numbers yet from them, but I know they're moving into, and they have 2-0 latency arenas, and they put in a Play VR from Neurogaming, and now they have the esport sitting, this consoles. Yeah, competition. Awesome. What about VR Studios? What about VR Studios? They had that the four-player... Yeah. Lighthouse competitive thing.
Power play. Something like that. Power play. Yeah. So yes, and they've been pushing esports very heavily. And I have to admit, I played their game. I know you did as well, Bob. That's the closest thing I've seen to competitive laser tag, even though they blew my ass away.
I actually was surprised. I quite enjoyed it, and I think it has a lot of potential. I think it's like it's 100 and something grand at 15%, which feels really expensive for what you're getting, which is like a half a dozen backpacks and a Lighthouse 2.0 and But I think the price will come down. The market will dictate, right?
Yeah. Or the market will dictate where someone who's got deep pockets. Is one of the things I'm waiting to see happen is companies like Dave and Buster's and companies like Main Event and Round One, who have the deep pockets and do like taking a punt, creating their own kind of emotions kind of pop-up yep. arcade system with the latest Rolls-Royce equipment and then rolling yeah. that out. And I think we've seen a little bit of that in what Dave and Buster's did with their four-rider simulator. That kind of, yeah. we've got big bucks and we can now create a standard for ourselves.
I like big bucks, I can't deny. Sorry.
Thank you. So the issue, I think the fundamental issue about adding esports is it's not simple. You really do have to work very hard as a manager and an operator, and you have to have a really good team. And a lot of this stuff, there's so much money being left on the table with a lot of these new VR arcade yeah. operators because they're so new to this. They forget about takeaway. They forget about the 40% rule regarding private parties. They forget about giving loyalty cards out. If you've got a guy that comes back to your facility, A, you want his friends to come along, and B, you want him to keep on coming back. And why are you giving him yeah. a nice piece of plastic with his name on it?
And that stuff's got to be in the system. That's got to be in the platform. It's got to be automated. And this is the thing yep. that I think the solution providers need to step up to is either adopt a standard platform that has all this stuff in it, whether it be Springboard or Synthesis or whatever, or build the capability to run the tournaments. Because like you said, the tournaments and the esports stuff is a lot of overhead and management. And I think that's what stops people from doing it. Not only the lack of knowing what to do, but then having to actually do it over and over and over again.
I had a client who's just gone through a major shakeup. He's sacked a lot of heads. He's trying to get back to, you know, the core idea. And, you know, he did some fundamental things, like he hired a team to develop their own unique CRM, customer relations system. And I walked into this. I said, why didn't you just buy that one off the shelf over there? Oh, well, we had to have our own exclusive one. Well, how much encryption have you got into the one that you've just spent all of this millions on? Oh, we haven't put encryption in. Oh, so it's illegal then. So they've binned that expense, and they've now had to go away and buy a CRM system off the show floor at IALPA. It's that kind of mentality. That blinker gets worse and worse. You know, I'm waiting for someone to say, oh, I'm building a head-mounted display because I can't find a good one. You know, you don't get into the weeds. Pick what the target of the audience you're aiming for and get the best products to suit them, their friends, and the people you haven't thought about who are going to be coming into your facility.
Awesome. Hey, so I'm putting up a link to Kevin's most recent article. There's a new website, LBE.
News.
Immersive, LBE News. And so Kevin's just started writing for them, and he put a big 2019 part one article up there. So I thought I'd share that with everybody. And that's in the chat right now. So click on that and give it a review. I didn't want to duplicate effort and talk about the stuff that we're talking about now that's already yes. covered in that article. But there's a lot of good shit in that article. So make sure you check that out. What else is so we've talked a little bit about standards, we've talked a bit about esports. What else is happening there that people should be looking for in 2019?
Well, it's the immersive entertainment market I'm fundamentally interested in, and we're looking beyond now virtual reality. We're looking towards the other aspects of the sector. So we're getting involved with some companies that are developing augmented reality systems. So awesome. augmented reality doesn't just have to be headset awesome. Systems. We've now got projection based enclosures or caves, showing my age there, computer automated virtual environments that people can walk into. And you know, we saw some really good examples at IALPA, including our friends from Scale One. Yep. And then
that was we all being distributed by Creative Works.
Yep. Yeah. So it's that kind. The one thing about the augmented reality and the mixed reality systems is that you don't have to worry about the headset, the tethered aspects, and also it offers a much higher audience appreciation. You fundamentally got to understand that most people go to entertainment facilities in groups. It's only the stupid people like myself that go on their own to these centers. And if these experiences block out the individuals that you're with, you can't share the experience. We're very social animals, and we feed off of each other when we're entertaining. And that's why a lot of the theme park industry is very scared about the head-mounted displays that totally blindfold you to the real world. Where now we're seeing...
So here's my problem. Go ahead, sorry.
I was just going to say, Bob, that we've got some companies out there developing see-through VR HMDs, such as Falcon, who demonstrated there. But go on, please.
Yeah, no. So my problem with the augmented reality stuff is that I almost feel like we're in the 90s of VR when it comes to AR, right? So the field of it's like looking through a keyhole, right? So when's the, you know, when is that going to get better? So you have, so I see two types of hardware.
HoloLens 2, please.
I see heads up displays, which are nothing more than notifications that are popping up in a window on glasses, which is just, you know, further driving the addiction to these things. So I see no entertainment value to those whatsoever. And then there's the stuff like Magic Leap and HoloLens, which still have this really narrow field of view. And so, you know, it looks like you're looking through a window that you know, and the field of view to me feels more dramatically bad in AR than it is in VR, because in VR, when everything else is blocked out, you focus on what you see and you're not thinking about field of view because you're focused on what you see. In AR, you see a lot more than what the augmented environment is, so it's way more, the narrow field of view is way more noticeable in AR and VR, and to me it just, like, I don't get it. I don't see the value from an entertainment standpoint there. And so do you agree with that or disagree enough?
I've seen some examples where that small field of view has been worked around. So if you look at what our friends at Me Leap in Japan have done, or if you look at Battleverse in Canada, they're creating kind of Dragon Ball Z games where you're launching fireballs, and that small field of view is great for seeing your fireball shooting off into the distance or the opponent's fireball.
I agree with you. I think the phone-based headsets.
Yes.
If you get a big enough phone and the right headset design.
Right headset.
But I think that works. I would agree with that.
Still your 90s analogy. That's still me looking at a black and white blocky pixel view of a game when really I want to see lush 3D graphics. Also, fingers crossed, you will be seeing, hopefully, if they're going to show it at CES, you'll be able to see the HoloLens 2, and you'll be able to see how much of a night and day comparison that technology
is.
I wouldn't be able to comment if I had. So the issue with this new generation of augmented reality, the reason I'm so down on our friends at Magic Leap was that I was hoping that they were going to be showing the Gen 2 quality of augmented reality display rather than a poor version of the three-year-old Gen 1 augmented reality. You know, elephants in your hand, it's definitely not. And the situation is that you'll be seeing at CES a lot of Gen 2 augmented reality, which could work very well in our sector. I don't believe it's really got much of a consumer application. Not everybody at home is really rushing out to buy a head-mounted display so they can see that someone's just called them on the phone, or that they can print a virtual TV screen in their room. But for us in the outer home entertainment market, you look at what some of the see-through VR experiences are achieving. They work really well. They are akin to a laser tag with a HUD, with a heads-up display. So again,
I think augmented reality and laser tag makes a ton of sense, and that's what I'd be doing if I was still in the laser tag business right now. I'd be developing HUD displays for laser tag, and I think that would be really cool. And I don't know if I'm assuming somebody's working on that. Nothing I've heard of. Okay, so
it's difficult because laser tag works to such short margins on how much people are prepared to pay, as well as upgrade their vests, that it's difficult. And you know, Eric, part of the Laser Tag Association, he can go into much more detail on what the market can bear. We're lucky. What we're doing is prepared to spend a lot more to be entertained than the traditional amusement industry or the traditional laser tags sector. Yeah. It's only just now that we're seeing the bowling industry adding projection mapping into their experiences and big screen and game interactivity. It's taken them a long time to embrace what I call gamification.
industries that have been around for 100 years or whatever it's been are slow to evolve, right? So I want to wrap up. There's a couple of things. So Juan just posted a question about Pimax. And I just want to address, Albert, that's a great question. I don't know that this is the right form for it. And frankly, I'm not sure there's any answers around the emerging business models. I think 2019, you'll start to see that stuff flesh out. But I think the people that are successful are single site successful. I don't know that anybody, as Steve Dooner has said, has rolled out a network of locations and found the formula. It's still a bit hit or miss, so we're still figuring that out. Juan's asking about Pimax.
So our friends at Pimax have been a real pain in the proverbial ass over trying to work with. They originally had a guy in China who was going to be handling location-based entertainment projects, but he disappeared in a puff of smoke. Pimax has got a whole load of problems that they need to deal with, and they're looking at out-of-home entertainment as just a pain. They have a couple of very exclusive relationships with certain individuals. So I think we're going to have to wait, give them 6 months before we're going to be able to seriously. You know, I've got people that wanted to buy 200 and 300 units of Pimax, and, you know, it made them sweat. They couldn't support that. They didn't have any idea of the metrics or the process. The same with our friends at HTC. It's taken them a long time to get a structure in place to be able to support out-of-home entertainment. And I think we've got a lot more to go through with Pimax in the next. You know, I've been told that the 5KX, the system that they're proposing to give to out-of-home entertainment, is much better than their 8K system that they're selling to the consumers. So again, we've got problems there. And then there's the rumor going around about
I'll see them at CES, but no, what's the rumor? I love rumors.
No, well, no, the rumor is that our friends at Valve, with their new virtual reality headset, they're going to be in a much better position to ramp up to support an out-of-home entertainment initiative. So maybe there could be an alternative to having to depend on wide field of view.
And Valve's got to be the wild card in this whole thing, right? Because they fucking do good shit. And they're the ones that create tracking technology.
Valve.
It works. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and Sony. And Sony.
Yeah. We'll see. But I'm really interested in Valve. The Knuckle controllers look really good. Obviously, the Lighthouse works great. I think that if they don't come out with shit products, right? And so if they're going to come out with a headset, it's going to be amazing. And I think that you can bank on that. If they come out with a product. So I did put up a link. I just want to close with, so Amusement Expo is coming up the end of March, March 26th, 27th, 28th. Kevin will be speaking on the 25th, on the 26th, we'll be having a full day education summit. Last year was the first year we did it. It was really good. It was standing room only. This year it's going to be five times better because we actually have time to prepare for it. We did it last week. We put it together in 6 weeks. This year we've had about 4 months to plan for it. And Kevin's going to be there talking about technology trends on a panel with some really good people that we can't announce quite yet. And so I've put a link to the brochure for Amusement Expo in Vegas. It's a one-day education summit, and then there's a two-day trade show. And it's where all of the traditional amusement industry comes, and we're bringing the VR community into that because the amusement guys have spend billions of dollars every year on equipment, and the VR community doesn't sell billions of dollars a year worth of equipment. And so I thought that that would be a good place to meet. So I hope to see you guys all there. Last words, Kevin.
Thank you for arranging this, Bob. More power to your elbow. I look forward to the next presentation. I'm going to be at the UK London's big EAG show. We're going to be doing a VR session on the 16th, where we're going to talk to some people. But that's more aimed at the arcade approach in the sector. And also, we've got a family Foundations Entertainment University taking place in London. But the big one is we look forward to seeing you in Vegas in March.
Awesome. Cool. So I want to thank everybody for being here. I want to thank everybody for engaging in the comments. It was really good. I do have to actually, Star VR died, Pimax at last year's CES sucks. That's funny. There's going to be a lot of roadkill in 2019 too.
Like,
I think you're going to see consolidation. You're going to see companies go out of business. You're going to see some new companies come in. You're going to see better funded operators come in. You're going to see some business models emerge. I think 2019 is going to be a really fascinating year for location-based VR and immersive entertainment.
Yeah, and thank you for the correction. It's January the 17th is our Foundations Entertainment stuff. But yes, you're right, Bob. It's going to be a confusing and chaotic stance. But the nice thing is, the reason why we're going to see so much confusion and roadkill is because this market becomes real.
Yeah, I think so. So I'll be sending out, for those of you that want to share this, I will be sending out a replay. I'll be posting this to my YouTube channel and I'll set links. Feel free to share it. And don't forget, Thursday next week, 8 a.m. Pacific, 11 a.m. Eastern, I'll be interviewing Charlie Fink live from CES. And then Friday, Holodeck. And then we'll be talking about hybrid tracking systems and then and mobile-based VR. And then, yeah, we're going to go on from there. We've got a great lineup, and I hope you guys enjoyed this. If you did, drop me an email with a comment about what you liked, what you didn't like, and what you'd like to see in the future, vrbob@bobcooney.com. And I will see you all live from CES on Thursday. Kevin?
Have a good one, everybody.
Awesome. Thanks a lot. Happy New Year. Talk to you soon.